Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1315.JO0714, certificate number 6555, the Tommy Westfall Universe.
Here's my son. I talk to him. I don't even know if he can hear me. Because he sits there all day long in his own world, staring at that toy. What's he thinking about?
Hello, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
Thomas, you are, as I understand it, in Hollywood, a working screenwriter.
I am working, you know, depends on one's definition of working, but here and there I work.
Uh-huh. And so I'm guessing that you take champagne showers and...
I hate to be... Of the working class screenwriter variety. I am one of the screenwriters who's just out here gigging and making it work and making ends meet, but making the trade-off of also having a pretty laid-back lifestyle. And, you know, when I work, I sometimes will go home and someone will say, "What's your day like?" And I'll say, "I don't know. I work for like 2 to 4 hours in the morning." And usually they say that sounds pretty nice.
That is pretty nice. It sounds like you're doing the millennial dream job, which is being retired already at 35 years old.
Yes. And you know, again, the trade-off, you say, all right, well, I can't go eat at, the Palm every night, but it's worthwhile. I'll cook some tofu at home in exchange for having the days a little more open.
Well, just briefly, can you tell me like what your dream scenario is? Like what is your dream that you would have a film made from a screenplay that you have written that you clutch as you walk around LA? Every meeting you go to, you have this like manila envelope that has your baby in it? Or are you hoping to become the head writer or just on the writing staff of some sort of like cartoon? Like what's the dream?
Yeah. I mean, the dream for sure coming out here was working on our TV writing staff. And I worked in the TV mines for a long time in writers' rooms, not on the staff, but at different levels of the support staff in the writers' room. And that's still something I'm vying for to some degree, but things have really moved. The waters are much more favorable in movies now, in features, than in television.
Really?
So I've sort of shifted my focus in that direction too. But I think, you know, one of the first things you learn as a working screenwriter is that none of these are your babies. You finish one and you say, time to move on. Like try to get it out there, do what you can, but do not say, if this one got made, I'd be set finally. You just say, okay, I've done what I can do here and move on to the next one.
Wow, that is emotionally hard for me to wrestle with, even having never written a screenplay at all. Just the idea that you'd pour what you were pouring into it as long as you did, and then you got to bounce.
Yeah, it can be tough. And there are for sure screenplays I wrote 6 years ago that are still very precious to me. And if you could point and just say, this one will be produced now, I would pick that over anything else. But then you also just say, but that's in the drawer. I can't think about it and I can't touch it. And I just have to keep working.
Now, when you say that the momentum or the energy is headed to film, I thought we were living in the golden age of television.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Yes, we were living in what a golden age of television for maybe 20 years. And then we had something of a triple whammy in the form of COVID, the big writer's strike just after COVID was winding down, and then the actor's strike concurrent with and extending beyond the writer's strike. And all of those made networks cut spending big time, cut the number of shows they're producing. And I've worked gigs that are just like full on, almost typing for hire gigs, where you're working alongside people who've run TV shows for decades, because that's just where the work is right now.
Wow. I thought that the pandemic was a boon for television. I thought everybody was sitting at home watching The Wire over and over, and it was a time that you could just make whatever. You could just throw anything at it.
You know, it's funny. It was a boon for television that had been made already. It was great if you had a show that had already been made. But that's also, you get, you know, shows like Severance that people watched in that time and loved. And then 5 years passed and they didn't make a new season of it until after all that time. So I think it's really just stopped things up. It stopped a lot of momentum. It scared a lot of networks and is oddly relevant here, because we are going to begin at another perilous time for television, which is 1980.
1980 was a perilous time for television?
I know, you wouldn't think so.
Wasn't Benson on the air? Didn't we have Benson and Silver Spoon? I guess it was before Silver Spoons, wasn't it? Dukes of Hazzard?
It kind of depends where you're looking. It was specifically perilous for NBC, which was the lowest of the three major networks at that point. But everyone was kind of staring down the barrel of this gun, which was cable had started going out nationwide in about 1970. And by 1980, maybe a quarter of the country had cable. So it wasn't yet critical mass, but there was this understanding that pretty soon, we were going to have more competition than just the three of us.
So, but 1980, you were not born, did, am I correct?
That's correct. Yes, I was born in 89.
Right.
So this is all received wisdom.
So you're looking back at 1980 television, and it might as well be I Love Lucy.
In terms of
your personal experience. Okay, yeah. So here we are, NBC... in the battle of the network stars, NBC is.
Yes, they're doing terrible. Out. And in part, the theory is because they had a whole idea, philosophy of least objectionable programming, which was basically the idea of there's only three networks. We just have to have the least bad show. We don't need to have the best show.
No way. Was it like no swears?
It was that, like nothing that would put people off. You can imagine kind of lowest common denominator. I mean, that's basically what it is. Lowest common denominator, least objectionable programming.
Terrible philosophy. I'm appalled.
And I believe that was the official name in-house, was least objectionable programming, coined by one of the vice presidents there. And now...
We were only 2 years away from the Letterman show, right? I mean...
Yeah. I think there's a big sea change coming, and okay. NBC is not primed at where it is right now in 80 to be a part of it.
Okay.
But now with cable growing in popularity, it's a big issue because, you know, they will no longer be the least bad of three networks. They will be competing against, 83 networks or 103 networks.
Right.
So... And of course, it's already not working for them because they're at the bottom of the ratings.
What were some of the programs on NBC at the time?
So at this point, NBC has Chips.
Which, you know, John and Ponch, delightful. And, you know, like they're real scamps sometimes. It's one of those shows where sometimes it's real like slapstick. And then the next one, it's real dramatic.
Yeah. You've got that. And, you know. Different Strokes was another one. And it's not necessarily like these shows still are known. They're not, you know, not total Drek necessarily, although, you know, maybe the legacy of Different Strokes isn't particularly.
But at the time, it seemed like a pretty progressive show.
But it's not working for them.
No.
They're not doing great. And some of these shows are, you know, I've also got Rockford Files was also on, which is like, it's a great time.
Great show. But that show dates back to 76 or something. That was.
And that's part of it, too. A lot of it's long running shows. They're still hanging around, but getting a little long in the tooth and maybe not as hot as they were when they started.
Right.
So NBC, the head of NBC, the chairman of RCA, actually, calls in this guy, Grant Tinker.
Grant Tinker, famous American.
Yes. At that point is the head of Mary Tyler Moore Productions and the husband of Mary Tyler Moore.
Wait a minute. I didn't know that. I thought Mary Tyler Moore was married to Rob.
I know. This is a heartbreaking to a nation, but she was married to executive Grant Tinker, who ran her company, and at this point is in the process of divorcing her.
Oh, no. How do you divorce America's sweetheart, Mary Tyler Moore?
I know. Apparently it was amicable. That's what I hear. But they're divorcing.
Okay.
And he goes to lunch with the chairman of RCA. And the chairman of RCA says, NBC's in the gutter. We're doing terribly. Why is that? And Grant Tinker lists off all these reasons why NBC stinks right now. The least objectionable programming. You guys aren't doing it right. And the chairman of the board says, all right, well, if you are so smart, how about you come be the president?
Well, so MTM, Mary Tyler Moore's production company, they made Lou Grant, right? Which was a hard-hitting drama.
Yes, MTM at this point has a fantastic reputation.
They made Rhoda.
They made Rhoda. They made Mary Tyler Moore.
Right, yeah. Which these were killer shows of their era.
And it's a huge, you know, influence on the rest of TV going forward. All these writers from Mary Tyler Moore Productions, MTM Productions, went on to create, you know, the next 20 to 30 years of television, including some of the ones we'll talk about here. And so, yeah, it's like you could not get more prestige at that time than MTM Productions. So you can see why they want this guy to come in and fix their network.
And he's newly single and he's thinking, well, you know, ready to mingle.
Yeah, it's funny. If you watch interviews with him, he will say, like, I really regret taking the NBC job because I got so much more money at MTM Productions than I did at NBC.
Oh, it was no really kidding. Bad financial decision. He became a salaryman instead of somebody that had a piece.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
But so as at MTM, before he left, he'd helped shepherd in a show called Hill Street Blues, which you may be aware of.
So, I mean, now I don't want this entire show to be about my childhood watching television, but Hill Street Blues was, when it arrived, it was really a sensation. It was the first of its kind, the first like gritty, what seemed at the time gritty realism, a lot of walk and talk style, you know, you're in the cops doing cop things. I think if I watched it now, the grittiness wouldn't seem gritty, but at the time it was like, this is like real life. They're just like real cops doing real cop stuff. And, it was a phenomenon. It was all anybody was talking about.
Yeah. It's a really big deal, but not initially in the ratings. Oh. It was a big deal critically and in terms of awards. But it was something like, of 97 shows that aired that year, it was 83rd ranked. The first year.
It was so acclaimed. It was really, and I watched it. My dad loved it. We were kids that watched TV with my dad, and he liked MASH, and my mom liked Magnum P.I., and, you know, my dad would watch old war movies, and my mom would watch. They had very different tastes in television, but Hill Street Blues was very much dad coded dramatic TV. That maybe there were some storylines that involved junkies and sex workers that were a little advanced for me at the age of 10 or 11, but it didn't stop him.
That's more or less my experience. My brother's 6 years older than me. And so I just watched whatever he watched. Yeah. And he was, you know, in high school and I was in fourth grade. Right. And I was just watching, you know,
90210. All these
movies. Yeah. 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 So, but Hill Street Blues isn't rated super well. But because of the critical acclaim, it just barely squeaks into a renewal and sort of kicks off this all important idea of demographics, which is that people with money watched Hill Street Blues and people in a certain, you know, 18 to 49, that's the number you hear. People in the 18 to 49 demographic watched Hill Street Blues. They watched the advertising and they bought the products off that.
This was the first time that advertising recognized that the show didn't need ratings. It just needed the right kind of ratings.
Pretty much. This is that era. And it kicks off this whole trend that by the mid 80s, critics are calling quality TV, which is what we now call prestige TV. Right. It's, you know, shows that their main defining feature is that they are not like the other shows on television. You can just tell this is, you know, this is provocative. This is usually pretty like liberal in its politics. It's usually pretty low rated. Usually not a lot of people are watching it. It's a big sea change because all of a sudden, you know, you are going from shows that are just getting canceled on the pure basis of, you know, only 25 million people watched this.
I know. Amazing, right?
to now all of a sudden, no, that could actually be enough. So Hill Street Blues skates on through and NBC wants Hill Street Blues in a hospital. That's their next big idea. They're like, Hill Street Blues is super edgy and it's the shaky handheld camera. And our idea, Grant Tinker's pitch for it is Hill Street Blues in a hospital.
But is this something that Grant Tinker came up with, or did some young executive say, check it out, Hill Street Blues? So
what Grant Tinker had was the framework. He knew Hill Street Blues and he knew medical dramas have been successful. So what if we could do that? But what they had was an MTM Productions writer in one of their writer's rooms already had been talking with a college roommate who was now a resident at a hospital in Cincinnati and had been collecting this guy's stories into a script. So they basically went searching for a hospital script that they could graft this idea onto. And this guy had that script. And that was Joshua Brand, I believe.
So not to seem, I know that my brand is guy that didn't watch TV, but we're talking about the era when I was still a kid.
Yeah.
And one of the things that MASH produced was a spinoff called Trapper John MD, which right. was a medical drama, right? Where Trapper John came back from the Korean War and went to a hospital. And it was not a successful television show, as if I recall.
Yeah, I don't think any of the MASH spinoffs did very well.
No, no, but there was some precedent that like a hospital, because there was Marcus Welby. I mean, hospitals did have.
Yeah, Ben Casey. Yeah. And they, you know, I think it's like any of those genres, like it is now. The hospital drama comes and goes, but there's all, you know, Grey's Anatomy is still out there doing its thing.
Yeah.
So they're kind of always there. And I think the idea was if we could revolutionize the cop drama like this, maybe we can also revolutionize the hospital genre. So Grant Tinker finds this script, greenlights a season of it. And shepherds it through the NBC process, and it gets a season, and it's pretty different out the gate from the other hospital series like they wanted. The biggest thing being what it took from Hill Street Blues, which was memory, remembering things that happened in previous episodes, which was previously kind of the domain of like soap operas.
Oh, sure. Because every sitcom is a brand new day, and it's just it lasts for 22 minutes, whatever that sketch is. But yeah, right. They're ongoing stories.
Yeah. And in the case of St. Elsewhere, really ongoing stories, things that will, you know, you'll do an arc of something and a character will drop out maybe for 3 years and then will come back and the audience is expected to remember who this guy was. And this is, you know, people don't have VCRs. They're not taping these shows, but that's part of this quality TV rubric where it's, you know, relies on the audience to put in a little bit of work, expects the audience to be paying attention while they watch the TV show, and then rewards them for doing so these callbacks.
Is this the dawn of the Easter egg?
I think sort of. You know, people talk about The Simpsons as like the first VHS show where, you know, they've got so many gags designed just for pausing and looking for.
Right.
St. Elsewhere kind of did it first. They really have a ton of running gags and references. And it's sort of, especially, you know, they barely get renewed for a second season. They are the 99th out of 100 shows after their first season. But they skate by because Grant Tinker, now president of NBC, formerly of MTM, the company that made St. Elsewhere, defends it and champions it and renews it for a second season.
Grant, how do you feel about your hair?
Being middle-aged, I feel okay about it, but, you know, it could be better, I'm sure.
Is it starting to recede?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Starting to see more forehead there.
More forehead. I saw some old pictures of myself the other day, and I thought, man, I didn't. My forehead's a lot bigger than it used to be.
What about up on the top? Are you starting to? Yeah, it's the place you can't see, but every once in a while you catch a photo of yourself and you're like, oh no.
Not yet, but I'm sure Father Time is coming for it.
I was reading an article about the hair transplant mega industry that's in Turkey now.
Ooh.
Billions of dollars they're making in Turkey by giving people from around the world this like totally crazy, you know, robot driven hair transplant. But I have an easier solution. I have a better solution, a more natural solution for our listeners. You're still a young guy, manager Grant, but
relatively,
when you get to be my age, which, you know, a lot of our listeners are like rolling their eyes. They're like, you're still a young man. Why? I'm 95. Those are listeners that started listening to the program when Ken was the co-host. But I have a marvelous solution for hair loss, and that is the company Hims. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medication, serums and sprays, whichever you feel like is the delivery method that works best for you and your busy lifestyle. These are doctor trusted ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can stop further hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. I've seen this if my own personal experience, my own eyes have witnessed hair regrowth. I think if you watch Ken on the Jeopardy program, you're going to be experiencing what I would describe as hair regrowth, Grant.
All right.
Because you think of Ken as a guy with like a lustrous head of hair. But I'll tell you, during the pandemic, man, the glare alone made it hard to do the show. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. I know this from past experience. I have gone way out of the way to help myself feel like myself. But Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Find the right hair regrowth treatment for you with flexible subscription options, access to 24/7 provider support, and once-a-day treatment options that fit your daily routine. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/omnibus. That's hims.com/omnibus for a free online visit. hims.com/omnibus. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Go to hims.com/omnibus. Hey, it's Grant the manager again. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm good. Enjoying this nice summer day here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I love the way that you are taking such a hands-on approach to management.
That's my only approach, John.
Uh-huh. Very hands-on. But I can tell from looking at you here, Grant, that although you're a very handsome guy, you're wearing a t-shirt.
I am a t-shirt. I know. I always, you know, I come to the bunker, do the addenda show. I'm there other times to meet with you, and I always feel like I need to step my game up, John.
Well, I'll tell you a nice thing. Now that the Northwest is getting so much hotter than it once did, I'd like to introduce you to linen fabrics. You know, they're cool. They breathe. They wrinkle in a very pleasing way.
Nice.
And, you know, typically you think of a linen shirt or linen pants as being kind of a luxury fabric, maybe inaccessibly expensive.
Yeah, totally. I do.
But I'm gonna hook you up today with Quince.
Quince?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Well, Quince absolutely has high quality essentials. A whole section of menswear that feels and looks amazing. Organic cottons, linens, but without the luxury markup, Grant.
I'm in. Don't look chopped.
Well, that's the thing. Don't be unk. Don't look chopped. But I know, you know, as someone who hails from the North Country, that you guys pinch a penny until it screams. It is okay to tease Norwegians and Danes and Swedes.
It's 100%, yes.
For being a little bit frugal.
Yep.
But Quince can put you, my t-shirt wearing friend, into linen pants and shirts, perfect for the warm weather, starting at just $34.
That's a steal.
I bet you that t-shirt cost $34 or more.
You know it did.
But they also have t-shirts, soft, easy to wear, lightweight cotton sweaters for those summer nights where the temperature drops a little bit. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar name brands that you would find in a store or even online that you would find online. Because they work directly with ethical factories, they cut out the middleman, so you're paying for the quality but not the brand markup. Also, Grant, Quince isn't just clothing. They have a lot of clothing for all genders, but they also have upholstered sofas, ceramic cookware, premium bedding. It's the kind of brand you end up recommending to everyone that you know for everything, just as I'm doing now.
I'm heading there soon.
So here's what I want you to do, Grant. And the next time I see you, I want you to have elevated your summer wardrobe. Although you're my manager, I can't boss you around, but I'm saying I want this for you.
Yeah,
go to quince.com/omnibus. That's quince.com/omnibus for free shipping with 365-day returns. Grant, that's, yeah. Can you repeat that back to me?
Oh, yeah, I can. Quince.com/omnibus.
Spell it.
Oh, quince.com/omnibus.
That's right. Free shipping, 365-day returns. Thanks, Quince. So as a scriptwriter, let me ask you.
Yeah.
Is there lore already going in, or is the lore something that develops as writers are frantically typing away and they're like, whoa, what was that thing? I bet his father was also a football player. Like, is the lore, how much of the lore do you have before you even start writing, and how much of it is super duper ad hoc and you're just trying to make it seem like we knew this all along?
So, you know, I can't speak to Saint Elsewhere specifically on this subject. There's not a ton about their writing process or production process, but a lot of shows, especially in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, would have a show Bible where it was basically any time a new fact was established in the show. Okay, he's got two sisters. He just said that in a line of dialogue. someone put that in the show Bible so that we can look back at this later and make sure that that's consistent across the whole of the series. So yeah, you'd for sure, you wouldn't necessarily be planning ahead of time. TV production's kind of too hectic for that. But as you went, you would be doing things, and in some ways it would be opportunities. You'd say like, oh, we need a story this week. Well, we said he has two sisters. What if they come to town? You know?
Right, right.
So a lot of TV is almost just improv with, you know, 10 people in a room instead of three or four on a stage. And you're just always thinking, what can I call back to right now? What can we use that we've done? Does anyone have a good idea, for God's sake?
But when you do call back, it does make it look like you knew all along that this was going to happen. And the two sisters show up, and then the two sisters become characters on the show. And it's like, oh, it took 3 years to bring them on, but we always knew they were there.
Yeah, exactly. And you can look really, really smart. And St. Elsewhere, it's genuinely impressive sometimes seeing that how they'll make references to something, yeah, 4 years earlier, but also not pat themselves on the back for it. They're kind of, you know, if you caught it, you caught it. But this is just, you know, that guy's back. Now he's shot one of our main characters, and now they got to heal that guy's wound.
And you're right. This isn't a time where people are rewatching the show from the start. Mm-mm. Over and over. It's, you know, now people are like, I've watched St. Elsewhere 14 times. But at the time, you had to have been there the whole time, and you had to have a mind to catch it. Wow.
Yep. Yeah. If you wanted to see it again, you had to wait for summer reruns, maybe. And that was, you know, still hit or miss on if they'd be showing them in order or how lucky you'd get there.
Right.
So yeah, it's very much ahead of its time in that sense. And a way it innovates on Hill Street Blues is that it is a much wilder show in terms of being willing to kill characters off or turn the tables on a character. You know, there's a running arc in the second or third season where there's like a serial predator in the hospital who's assaulting people. And it turns out to have been one of the doctors who's been there since episode one. And then he's fired. And then later he comes back because of a lawsuit. They're really doing all this stuff from soap operas where you just keep building the story. Okay, yes, and what's next? It was pretty middlingly popular its whole run. It squeaked to a second season, but unlike Hill Street Blues, it didn't then become a juggernaut. It just continued to barely hold on with a dedicated fan base of yuppies who could keep it going for, in the end, 6 years.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I'm realizing, you know, I haven't said the premise of the show, but it is a hospital drama built around this hospital, St. Eligius, which is derisively called St. Elsewhere.
Because it's a shitty hospital on the edge of town.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. It is the less impressive hospital compared to Boston General, the big fancy hospital. And so all of our characters, you know, it's got a huge ensemble, which included a young Howie Mandel.
Oh, sure.
Ed Begley Jr. And Denzel Washington. Is
what?
In.
No way.
This shocked me to learn. Denzel Washington got his start on St. Elsewhere.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. A role he apparently took because it was a huge ensemble. So he knew that if he wanted to go do a movie, they could just not feature him for a couple episodes.
Whoa.
He wasn't going to have to be there every single week filming, but he's there a lot. They've got storylines about him.
What's funny is this was a time when Boston, I guess, was still considered America's third city. Because
right.
There were so many television shows set in Boston, of all things. Nowadays, I don't think you would set a television show in Boston if Boston paid you $1 million. But back then, it was like, oh, yeah, Boston, that's a gritty, cool town.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, Cheers, obviously. Yeah. It was for some reason, a big hub.
We were talking about Boston a lot.
they thought it was going places, but I shouldn't say that. But so they go through the first season, and the one note they kind of get after season one is this is a little too dark. Even Grant Tinker, who wanted Hill Street Blues in the hospital, thinks it's a little too dark.
Does that mean like blood? There's too much blood, or the storylines involve too much human tragedy?
I think both. And the show continues to feature human tragedy. But like season one, there's a plot line. The first episode has a terrorist who sets a bomb off in the bank. And the two people who get injured by it are a woman who's in the bank and the terrorist himself. And the hospital is treating both of them as patients. A woman who's in a coma now and the unrepentant terrorist who blew up a bomb in a bank. And they follow his...
Does it get into his politics?
It's pretty vague on why he did it. It's he's just, and he's played by Tim Robbins, by the way, a young Tim Robbins.
Oh, so it's implied that it's some kind of IRA thing that would
something, yeah, Boston. Or like maybe like Weather Underground-esque situation. Robbins. Yes, and they follow him for four episodes. He lives, but his victim dies, and the victim's husband comes into the hospital and shoots the terrorist one day. It's all this stuff. Again, every storyline you talk about on this show, any extended storyline, will eventually turn into this, like, this is just keeps escalating into further madness. And so it was stuff like that. And they stuck to that, but then they sort of brought in the second season a quirky sense of humor that was not as present in the first season.
Yeah, they brought in Scrappy-Doo.
Right. And they start doing a lot more little jokes and allusions to other MTM production shows and to other shows from TV's history. And it kind of becomes a little bit of like a 30 Rock. It's not as funny as 30 Rock or Community. It's not, you know, they still have super dramatic stories, but they're doing that same, here's a super obscure reference to some TV show that nobody watching knows about because, you know, the one of the writers on our staff worked on it in 1971 or whatever.
And are they doing it where the characters in St. Elsewhere are aware that it's a reference to television, or are they doing it as though the world of television is the world that St. Elsewhere occupies, and so it's real life to them?
It's more that, and it's never as explicit as like, oh, Mary Tyler Moore came by the hospital today, but it will be, you know, we're paging over the PA, the... you know, title character of some show
right.
from 10 years ago.
And Rob Petrie, Rob Petrie.
Precisely, yeah. So they'll do that and they get very playful with it. And they do a couple crossovers, the biggest of which is in season three. In fact, they go to Cheers. Three of the doctors go to Cheers. They're razzed by Carla.
Do they show up on Cheers too?
They didn't know. It was only Cheers came to them. They did not.
No, they missed the opportunity to have a true crossover.
I know. They didn't close the loop, which is disappointing. But they go to Cheers, and it's, you know, again, this weird mixture. And I think part of what the quality TV thing is, you come back to this weird mixture of high and low, you know, the almost like pre-Twin Peaks, the tendency of a show to be really goofy in one moment, but then in the same scene even get really, really serious. And like, anyway, my wife slipped in the shower and died this morning.
Right.
Like,
right.
All right. And you know, one's mileage varies as to how well you ride those waves between tones. but it's unlike anything on TV at that moment. It's totally original and weird and bizarre. And again, self-referential and meta about television in a way that TV shows haven't really been up to that point.
And are they having an influence in their moment? Like Miami Vice came along a couple of years later and became the new cultural determiner, where everybody was wearing pink and powder blue all of a sudden. And it had, but Miami Vice had like cool music and drugs, but it also had this, like, this is a really dramatic scene where people are dying, but then somebody slips on a banana peel, like, you know, like, yeah. Did St. Elsewhere set the tone for other shows?
I think a little bit, but not as much as you might think. A lot of its influence was in the more dramatic parts, in that serialized storytelling that refers back to itself, where things that were important early on can become important later. I think, you know, you do get other shows. Like, I've never seen the show Picket Fences, but I think it has a similar kind of goofy tone to it and was another of these big shows of the early 90s or late 80s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, less than you might think on the tone side, but in terms of structure, for sure.
So it goes 6 years, which are which coincide with the whole time I was in high school and into college.
Yeah.
Somehow I dodged ever seeing it, but it was there the whole time.
It was there the whole time. And then finally, you know, after fighting for its life for 6 years, it actually manages to come to an intended conclusion. The writers on the show know that this is their last season. The last season gets especially metatextual, where they talk about the hospital being bought by a large corporation that now they have to please, which is right around the time that NBC is purchased by GE. And, you know, these kinds of things. Again, you think about like 30 Rock, where you make these jokes that are exactly about what's happening in the real world at that moment, but has been transmuted to the format of the show.
I mean, Letterman was doing it the whole time, but he's a talk show. He's, you know, when he talks about their new corporate masters at GE, it was also shocking. We were like, wow, this guy's got no, he owes nobody anything. But that, yeah, seeing that go into a sitcom, or not a sitcom, a dram-com.
Yeah, yeah. And pretty much, I think it would probably basically classify itself as a drama. And you're right, yeah, they're doing that metaphor of what's happening in the real world within their dramatic TV series where, yeah, the hospital's bought, they have to please new corporate masters, they're all worried about selling out and losing the true mission of the hospital.
Well, here's a question for you as a screenwriter. How often does the writing staff know that this is the final season versus a writing staff that's the whole season long writing their little tails off trying to get picked up, and so the end of the season is just like, oh well, womp womp, as opposed to like building to a climax?
I would say, and this is an unscientific estimate, but I would say 90% of the time, if not more, they have no clue that their show is going to end, or they don't have any way to guard against whether their show is going to end. They just have to write it hoping they get more. And especially in this era, if a show's doing well, you don't end that show. Cheers runs for 11 years. You know, Law and Order runs for 20 plus years. These shows are not designed to end. And so it's not really until prestige television and The Sopranos and Mad Men and Breaking Bad and shows like that where a show can, again, a successful show, you still have to be successful, but it becomes more ordinary to say, actually, we've told all the story that we have to tell now. We're going to wrap this up intentionally and stop making the network the massive amounts of money that our show is making them. But a lot of times, yeah, these shows don't know that they're ending. And this was a rare chance where they knew it, they planned it. And in fact, because they'd been up for cancellation pretty much every year prior to that, every year they had been pitching, how are we going to end this show? If we have to end this show, what's the ending? And they started writing them up on a bulletin board. In particular, one writer, Tom Fontana, who got his start on St. Elsewhere and over the course of the series rose up through the ranks to being one of its top writers. And he was charged with deciding on the ending. He pitched a couple endings to the showrunner, who, as a very small side note, was Gwyneth Paltrow's dad, Bruce Paltrow, is the showrunner of St. Elsewhere.
I'm just going to let that one just fly on by.
A little Hollywood story. But so he pitches a couple possible endings to the show. One of them is that episodes often ended with two of the doctors going into the chief of staff's, chief of medicine's office and having sort of a thematic conversation about what had happened that day. And so he had the pitch of they go into the office, they have their thematic conversation, and then they look out the window and a nuclear bomb has been detonated and the whole hospital is destroyed. So that was one of, you know, that'll close it off.
I would have voted for that, frankly. That just seems like it's hard. And at the time, especially, like, hard to argue. Very, very ripped from the headlines.
And the mission statement for Tom Fontana very much was, I don't want this show to have a reunion in 20 years. I do not want a show where, you know, all these actors are going to come back old and just retread this same ground. And, you know, to his credit, that hasn't happened. So I guess it worked. But another of his pitches was that one of the older paternal doctors would be talking to one of the other older kooky doctors, friendly kooky doctors. And the kooky doctor, Dr. Auschlander, would say, well, there's something I've been meaning to tell you. I was the second gunman at the JFK assassination, and now I'm going to kill you too. And then he shoots the other guy, and that's the end of the show. So you can tell at this point there's this bit of like just a burn the house down on the way out mentality.
Yeah. Which, you know, you kind of admire, but also these are terrible ideas.
Absolutely. Yes. I think that one in particular would have really, if the actual finale was controversial, I think that one may have topped it in terms of controversy. But what they end up going with is a scene where the chief of medicine, Dr. Donald Westfall, who the whole show through has been kind of the steady presence, the elder figure who looks after the doctors, who often is the sort of the moral and emotional heart of the show. The whole run of the show has had this recurring issue where he has an autistic son, Tommy, who's nonverbal. And he's sort of always grappling with this question of, I want to connect with my son, but he can't talk. I don't know if anything I say gets through to him. I don't know.
Is this the first autistic character on television?
That is a good question, because they did break a lot of ground like that. Like one of the big things I didn't say earlier is they're the first primetime drama to have an AIDS episode. Mm-hmm. So it is not, you know, I cannot say definitively this is the first depiction of autism on TV, but it's certainly an early one and a pretty like empathetic, thoughtful one, depending on how you choose to read the finale in that light, as we'll get to. But he has had this son, and it's the end of the episode, and he and his son are staring out the window of the hospital and watching the snowfall. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous scene. And you hard cut to Tommy Westfall, the son, sitting on the floor of a living room, staring into a snow globe. Dr. Donald Westfall comes home from work, except he's dressed as a construction worker. And his father, who was another of the doctors on the show, his father in the scene is sitting in an armchair waiting for him. And Dr. Westfall, or now construction worker Westfall, says, how's he been? And his father says, same as always. He hasn't said a word all day. And Westfall goes over to his son and he says, you know, I just wonder what he's thinking about. And then takes the snow globe from the kid and says, come on, let's go have dinner. Puts the snow globe down on top of the living room TV set. And as they exit, we close in on the snow globe. And inside the snow globe is St. Eligius Hospital, the hospital from the TV show. The implication being that everything that's just happened, 6 years of television, has happened inside the imagination of this construction worker's nonverbal autistic son. And good night. That's the end of it.
What?
Yeah, it's pretty out there, and it was a controversial finale. It was
so before, it was all a dream.
Pretty much, it was all a dream. It was all a fantasy finale where the kid dreamed it up. His dad's not a doctor. The other doctor is not a doctor. Nobody here was real, and he just has a snow globe with a hospital in it, and dreamed this whole thing up. And this is not something the show has ever alluded to before. This is not one of the long-running payoffs that finally makes sense with the rest of the show.
There's another way of looking at that's pretty delightful.
Yes, and I think you're right. I think it depends how you feel, where you land on that, because the show, as we've talked about, it was weird and playful, and they crossed over with Cheers, and they had an episode where a character dies and meets God, and God looks like him, and then he comes back to the operating table. And he's back alive. You know, it's like they were doing wild episodes the whole time through. So this was of a piece with that in a way. But yeah, a significant number of audience members felt like the show was basically saying, screw off. This was all fake. All your invested emotions meant nothing. And, you know, I think from the writer's perspective, it was, how can we do something that's not just another, like, well, life goes on at St. Elsewhere, as every other show
Right, right.
Does.
Pan away from the hospital and fade to static. Yep. Yeah.
Exactly. So it makes waves, but you know, some TV critics say it's bold. And especially in retrospect years later, I think a lot of people look at it as another of these quality TV hallmarks of they took a swing. Whatever you think of it, the show didn't go out on a mute note. It really, right. really went for it.
Right. And it's meta, right? It points a finger at this is television. It was not real life. And
exactly. Yeah, exactly. There's that element too. And I think for the writers just to say, and we're done with this too. We're like, we don't want to, yeah, don't bring it back.
Right.
We love this world and we want it to end now and not in some other person's hands years down the line. So all's well that ends well, more or less. They get some hate mail, but they move on. People go off to different shows and keep working. Tom Fontana goes on to create the show or co-create Homicide.
Life on the Streets.
Life on the Streets, which is another, at that time, extremely hard-bitten show that's super dark and gritty, that hasn't aged as much as Hill Street Blues, but, you know, you still got that aspect to it.
Hey, Grant the Manager, how are you?
I'm doing all right, John. How about you?
Super good, super good. I just got back. I took a little trip down to California to a conference of older guys like me, except older. And a lot of the conversation sort of revolves around the fact that, you know, when you're in your 30s, everything kind of comes easily to you. You rebound from physical activity, you have a lot of energy, but then sometime in your mid-30s and your 40s, suddenly everything that used to be easy isn't as easy. Have you experienced that now that you're a man that's longer 22?
Yeah, in my 40s, I can tell you, you know, you do things. I do try to work out a little bit here or there, John, and I, you know, suddenly you do something wrong, you twist something, you strain something, and, you know, in your 20s and 30s, it just comes right back. And now, man, weeks on end where I'm like, it still hurts in the back, still hurts in my arm.
Mm-hmm. It's rough. And a funny thing is that in the case of men, we don't really talk about it that much. But from the age of 30 on, you start losing the testosterone in your body by about 1% every year. So by the time you're 50, I mean, do the math. You've lost 20% of your testosterone. And what I learned recently and learned in this conference of gray-haired dudes is your testosterone gets locked up and can't be used. There's a protein that's called SHBG that basically handcuffs your testosterone. So even if your body's making it, SHBG locks it up and you can't access it.
How do you unlock it? That's what I need to know, man.
Well, I have recently learned this. Mars Men is designed to help free locked testosterone so your body can actually use it. There's no synthetics. You don't have to use needles, which is kind of like in the old days. This was a shot you had to take.
Right.
But Mars Men just uses real ingredients that help optimize energy, focus, and strength.
Man, I'm glad to hear that because needles were not in the cards for me. But, you know, something like this, I'm totally in.
And this is especially true if you go to the gym. You know, this helps you recover faster from your hard workouts. It helps support healthy T levels, gives you energy and stamina. It's got 8 natural, clinically dosed ingredients, things like Tonghat, Ali, Shilajit, vitamin D, zinc, boron, and more. And as you know, this is important to me, it's made in the USA.
Yeah, exactly. That's huge for any sort of supplement, in my opinion.
You get a 90-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. Worst-case scenario, if you don't absolutely love it, you get your money back. But over 91% of users report higher energy levels, and you're going to feel it. Thousands of guys are feeling incredible results. I mean, just go check out the reviews of Mars Men on the website to see for yourself. So for a limited time, our listeners, and this includes you, Grant, although you're more than a listener to me.
But I am a listener.
You'll get 50% off for life, plus free shipping and three free gifts at mengotomars.com. That's mengotomars.com for 50% off and three free gifts when you check out. After you purchase, they will ask you where you heard about them, and please support Omnibus by telling them that you learned about Mars Men from the Omnibus Project. Grant, have you got a kitty cat?
I got two cats.
I knew that about you. I asked you.
Yes.
I asked you, but I know your kitty cat story.
That's right.
And are your kitty cats fussy eaters?
No, they're pretty good. They're pretty good eaters, I have to say. Maybe too good. One of them.
Too good. Are you somebody that pampers their cats, or are you somebody that just sort of treats them like farm animals?
Oh, I mean, in the great human history of having cats, I probably pamper them more than farm animals.
Yes. Well, let me introduce you to an incredible way to pamper your animal, and also kind of to treat them like your little human friends. I'm talking about Smalls. Smalls is fresh human grade cat food that does so much more than just feed your cat. It helps them live full and healthy lives. Most cat food out there, Grant, is made with meat byproducts, cheap fillers, and artificial ingredients. Basically stuff that isn't great for your cat. I try hard not to eat all that stuff, although, I mean, I get by without meat byproducts or cheap fillers. Artificial ingredients are a little harder to avoid, but why would we give our cats those things?
I don't know, man.
Well, you know why? It's because big pet food does it, because it's cheaper to make. But what they save on cost, your cat pays for with their kitty cat health. But Smalls, Grant, Smalls is different. Their fresh recipes are made with at least 80% animal protein, and they're gently cooked, because, of course, a cat isn't going to cook in its native environment. They're gently cooked to retain all their nutrients and flavor. They never add fillers or artificial ingredients, and their food is so healthy that 88% of cat parents say that after feeding Smalls, their cats have better digestion, a softer and shinier coat, and more energy to play, because it's actually good for cats. And also, they include little treats, and my cat goes bananas for those treats, like flipping out. Actually the best. Actually awesome to watch. Your cat's health, Grant, and longevity starts with what they eat, and I'm going to encourage you and all of our listeners to try Smalls. You'll get 60% off your cat's first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you go to smalls.com/omnibus. 60% off your first order, free shipping, free treats that drive your cat absolutely bonkers with joy for life when you head to smalls.com/omnibus.
But things sort of go quiet on the St. Elsewhere finale front until about 1999, when...
A decade later.
Yeah. 10, 11 years. And users of the Homicide Usenet board start talking because...
No.
Yeah. the place to be in 1999, The Homicide Usenet board, because a character from St. Elsewhere went on to appear in Homicide. One of the nurses who had multiple episodes on St. Elsewhere shows up in Homicide as her character.
Oh.
And, you know, she's accused of euthanizing a patient in, you know.
And is Homicide produced by the same production company? Is it also on NBC? Is it part of a...
It is the same. It's NBC, and it's the same. It's Tom Fontana, who wrote the finale of St. Elsewhere. So he's the head writer on Homicide now. So, you know, for him, this is just a fun, oh yeah, she was great. Let's bring her back.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be funny if she had the same name and was also a nurse? You right. know,
okay.
Those games writers love to play.
Yeah.
But they, you know, people on this board start to postulate, well, does that mean homicide is also part of this kid's dream? If the character from Saint Elsewhere all exists in Homicide, okay, so both those shows exist in the same world.
Right, because so, Tommy Westfall, if it was all in his mind, there's no sign at the end that he's ever been to St. Egregious Hospital. He's not populating his fantasy world with actual people, presumably, because
right.
his dad's a construction worker, and it's not like he's...
Yep.
I see.
Yeah. So that's, you know, they're talking about they're having fun, and in particular, this guy, I'll make sure I get his name right, Keith Gao, is a, of course, a trivia nerd, who starts putting together how many other shows this might affect. How many other shows crossed over with Homicide?
That's something that my former co-host of the Omnibus program, this is right up his alley.
I can imagine. Might want to see what Usenet boards he was on in 1999.
I'm going to text him and say Tommy Westfall universe. And if I don't get a flood of nerd gibberish back, I'll be surprised. Well, so how much crossover was there with Homicide?
So with Homicide, there's just the one, maybe one or two characters connect between St. Elsewhere and Homicide. But then Homicide, and kind of one of the patient zeros of this whole thing, has a character, Detective Munch, who ends up appearing on 10 or 11 different cop shows, including some 240 episodes of SVU.
Because SVU is a spinoff of Homicide.
Yeah, well, it's a weird thing. A lot of the cop shows, I think, just shared DNA, shared writers. You know, if you've written one cop show and there's a new cop show starting, you want a guy who knows how to do the cop stuff. So you bring that guy over. And in this case, I think it began as a fun thing of, oh, yeah, well, you know, this takes place in Baltimore, or we'll say that Detective Munch came up to New York for a week, and now he's in Law and Order. And now we start Law & Order SVU. Wouldn't it be fun if he was a real character in this and had a real major role? And he even at one point shows up in The Wire.
This just becomes like a thing that writers are doing as an inside joke with one another.
Later on, it becomes that. With Detective Munch, no one, I think, has yet thought about the Westfall universe, the St. Elsewhere of it. At this point, they're just thinking, we like this actor.
Oh, wait, it's Richard Belzer.
Yes, Richard Belzer plays Detective Munch, yep.
So he's Munch, and he shows up in all these different shows?
All these different shows, yep. Which, you know, then he even shows up at one point in The X-Files, which is another of these sort of ones that... A lot of these, and at some point I'll machine gun through one or two of the like crazy trains of connection that we are dealing with here.
Okay.
But you know, because so Detective Munch is a big one, and then the other big one is the aforementioned Cheers crossover episode,
right.
Because then Cheers spins off Frasier, and both of them have plenty of like little crossovers with different shows. Like Frasier, here, I'll just run through one of these very quickly, but they go to Cheers in St. Elsewhere. Frasier is on Cheers. In Frasier, they refer to characters, they meet characters from Caroline in the City, which is, you know, one of these sitcoms from the late 90s that,
right.
that goes on. Caroline in the City crosses over with Friends at one point. A character shows up there. Friends crosses over with name drop Mad About You.
That's right. You were a screenwriter on the reboot of Mad About You.
Yes, I was part of that as a script coordinator. And
now, wait a minute. Does that put you somewhere in the Tommy Westfall universe?
So that's sort of the thing. The Keith Gao and Ash Crow, who helps him put together this first iteration of the Tommy Westfall universe chain of connections, they kind of come up with some rules to limit it. And one of them is that this does not go into the real world. If David Letterman appears in an episode of Homicide as David Letterman, it doesn't mean that we all just live in the St. Elsewhere universe, because at that point it just becomes sort of untenable to keep, you know, at that, as soon as David Letterman exists in St. Elsewhere, then it's every single person David Letterman has ever had on his show. And
let me just go back, because I may have missed something, but
yeah,
at what point did the writers become aware that this was something that was being discussed on Usenet, and did they lean into it?
So the writers, I don't think, become aware until maybe the early 2010s, or if they're aware, it doesn't become sort of a widely known thing until about that point, which is when I think the first real map of the Tommy Westfall universe is published online. And they, for the most part, these are just wild connections that happen because TV used to be a place where someone from one show would walk into the set of another show for a single episode, and they would have brand synergy, and then they would move off on their own. And it was, you know, it's kind of a weird sign of the times of what television used to be, where now, you know, Game of Thrones, you're not going to have, you know, the characters from Lord of the Rings walk through Game of Thrones, and even as a winking kind of reference, shows are too serious for that sort of thing. But back when TV is still kind of like the trash medium, you can do that. It doesn't matter that much. It's funny. Well, wouldn't it be funny if these guys showed up in the Cheers bar?
But so when this starts in 2000, in order to make these connections, I guess Usenet is necessary, right? Because it'd be very unusual for one person to have watched every television show. But
yeah.
But on a news group, there are going to be people that are like, oh, you know.
Exactly. And as this information starts to spread across the internet, more and more people say, oh, well, you guys forgot that this character, you know, from the, it's funny, the Mad About You connection, a character from the Dick Van Dyke Show appears on Mad About You at one point as his character from the Dick Van Dyke Show, which now means that all of a sudden you're going back in time too and involving the Dick Van Dyke Show in this boy's imaginary universe, this black and white show from the 60s. So it really is, yeah, you need this brain trust of all these different people who know, you know, the lore of Mad About You, which even having worked on it, I am not that read up on. Just barely. So yeah, it really is a true like internet phenomenon, I think, to be able to piece all this stuff together and then to finally make it into this massive encompassing chart and evolving, because shows continue to even occasionally do crossovers, especially network shows like Law and Order will still have that occasional episode where, oh, what if we did one, but it takes place in this town where this show is set and a character shows up. So it continues to grow.
Yeah. You sent me this, this graphic,
yes,
to reference, which just looks like a bunch of soap bubbles in the shape of like maybe Sicily. And I didn't have the right glasses to look at it. But now that I realize what it is.
Yes. So you can zoom in there and we'll see, you know, I'm sure we may have Mark Miles with the graphic, but as a quick show of what this thing looks like.
It's crazy. You've got Charlie's Angels and the Bionic Woman.
Yeah.
But so a lot of this goes back in time.
Yeah. And a lot of them, they can be pretty tenuous. One of the big things that you'll get is something like a character smokes this fictional brand of cigarette that was also featured on Homicide. Therefore, this must take place in the Homicide universe. So like, there's some
and any show that has a 555 telephone number might apply.
And, you know, again, they have certain rules to try and keep it from getting too out of hand. One of the rules being if it's connected by a fictional product or if something to that effect, the fictional product has to have featured majorly in at least one show. It can't just be, you know, you can barely glimpse the label, because Otherwise, that's all of production design is using made up labels
right.
across different shows.
I do see that the most tenuous connection is brand, item, etc., which is the yellow yellow thread. And there is an awful lot of yellow thread.
The further out you get, especially once you start getting to science fiction, because that's when you start getting into like a sci-fi show will say that something was made by the Weyland-Yutani Corporation, which is just the company from Alien. And
right.
they're just referencing Alien, and some writer, you know, they're not even thinking of it as a crossover. They just think it's fun and cool to put the famous Alien company into their TV show.
Right. If it's like a box of Acme TNT, then it's everybody. But I do see a lot of cameos.
Yep.
Where it isn't just the crossover seems like the rarest species.
But cameo gets you pretty far.
It does, right? And there's a lot of TV here that seems like instead of writing a good episode, the writers were just like, you know, it'd be funny. We'll just get somebody from a different show in here, and what a gas.
Still, it's still that thing of they're just putting in because it's a fun reference to their own work, something they worked on previously. It's a real connection of high and low in television. Where, you have this stuff where it's just like some guys, it's like, can we just bring Rhoda from Mary Tyler Moore on this week? And it's about what if Rhoda came to town?
Right, right.
And then other times you have these things where it's like, maybe the reference is subtler. Tom Fontana, the writer of the finale of Saint Elsewhere, creator of Homicide, also went on to create Oz, the first HBO drama.
Oh, yeah.
And the corporation that bought the hospital in Saint Elsewhere also buys the prison in Oz at one point and becomes a corporate-run prison. And so, you know, Oz is included for that reason. But you can imagine that Tom Fontana is over there thinking, like, this is fun. Yeah, it's the same company. They're like a really evil corporate overlord that just keeps buying up hospitals and prisons.
So in 2010, this becomes something that people are actually talking about enough that it gets back to Hollywood.
Yes.
Who obviously, I mean, Hollywood's scriptwriters have their finger on the pulse of the culture, and everybody's on Twitter by that point, so you can't escape knowing.
Yep.
And then what happens?
And at that point, they do start leaning into it. At that point, you are getting much more intentional. Like Tom Fontana goes on to create a Showtime show called City on a Hill, where at one point a character is referred to as being sent to St. Eligius Hospital off screen, reference to the St. Elsewhere Hospital. So at this point, he knows, he's talked about it in interviews, and he is clearly consciously now having fun with it and roping in as much of TV as he can. And it's kind of funny because he actually winds up being weirdly touched by it when he talks about it. He's like, he says, has a quote that essentially, you know, they made this show and they thought that they were just a speck in the TV universe. And instead, now it feels like they encompass the entirety of the TV universe. And so, you know, for him, it's kind of like a justification of here's 6 years we spent making something weird and distinctive and original. And now it actually, you know, the show's not on DVD. I think season one is on DVD. You can't stream it anywhere right now legally. And so there's a way in which this is its legacy, is this show that broke ground at the time, but then sort of got memory hold, is now in a weird way the overlord of all television.
And we all have this dream of a third act where, with no help from you, somebody discovers something that you made 30 years ago and either resurrects it or works from it or remakes it. And all of a sudden you have this thing that you didn't have to do anything, but you just became like a dimension larger. Like, what a fantastic thing to have happen.
Yeah. Especially because I do think, you know, I've got this book here that was one of my sources called Television's Second Golden Age. And it was published in 1996. And it's about how the 80s were a golden age for television, the second golden age after like the 50s and Edward R. Murrow and all them. And there is something interesting about the way that prestige television and The Sopranos and Mad Men came along and sort of erased all of our memories of the idea that we used to think other TV was good before this too. Before we knew that the other things were coming, there was at least this sense of TV as a cultural like mover. And in particular, these shows, Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere and Twin Peaks and things like that, as true elevations of the medium.
Yeah.
We'd reached a new level where it was no longer just the boob tube and schlock for dummies. It was real art that was being put out on the airwaves.
Does Twin Peaks enter into the Tommy Westfall universe?
Incredibly, I do not think so. I said that without double checking.
But it didn't cross over with X-Files. It seems like that was, you know, those two were together in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, David Duchovny was on both shows, but he didn't play
the same guy,
the same character. So if it's on there, I could only imagine it would be one of these tenuous,
right,
dreaded yellow brand item connections.
So let me ask a couple of things. Did Tommy Westfall himself ever appear again as himself in any show?
No, I do not believe so. He did not go on to act as a career. At some point in the years later, in the 2010s, he commented on just how crazy and wild the phenomenon was of him being the guy with all this in his head. But I'm sure he's not a dentist, but he was something like a dentist now. He's moved on with his life.
And in your opinion, what is the most egregious, pandering example of a subsequent writer, which I can only imagine is in recent years, like in a really hack way, making sure that their thing enters into the Tommy Westfall universe?
Wow. That is,
I mean, I don't want you to criticize the guy that lives across the street from you, but
no, I mean, you know, I guess one of the ones, and I can't say when in the continuum this exactly happens. I do know that Scrubs at one point has an explicit reunion of the St. Elsewhere cast, like has some members come onto the show in a way where, they're both doctor shows. It doesn't not make sense, but
it's in violation of the code of not having a St. Elsewhere reunion.
Yeah, I know. I don't think Tom Fontana was consulted for that one, unfortunately.
But then Scrubs is also more comedy than drama, right?
Yeah, and it was funny, you know, rewatching and watching a lot of St. Elsewhere for this, seeing how much the DNA is kind of there. It's also, when it's a goofy medical show, St. Elsewhere is a goofy medical show, and you say, okay, well, this is not too far in its funny moments from, you know, maybe not quite having fantasy sequences in the same way, but there's connective tissue.
And then I guess my other question is, are there now, because although I never watched any of these shows, and when you pitched Tommy Westfall Universe, I knew about it because I'm nerd adjacent.
Yeah.
And in the giant soup of nerd culture that recapitulates nerd culture that is based on 1,000, you know, referential inside jokes and combinations and recombinations. Yeah. I was aware of that this existed. Is there or are there people trying to create their own Tommy Westfall universes in different kind of media? Like, what are the examples of this kind of world?
Well, I think that that's one of the things that maybe has made it such a hooky idea, is that it sort of exemplifies traits unique to television as a medium, which is to say, even in novels, maybe you will have an author who carries a character over into another novel they write, maybe not even an explicit sequel, but they continue the story of that person as a side character. But you don't, in the same way you do with TV, have that same nucleus of a TV show where now a dozen or more writers have pollinated the rest of television once that ends. And now they're all making little references to their old show. And then that catches on with the people in that room who then blast off into their own worlds, while at the same time having these works that last for so many years and have so many different voices on them. And frankly, have so many lulls where maybe they're willing to try something a little absurd to kick up ratings for a week. You know, there's a lot of phenomena that are specific to television that lend themselves to creating this universe that I think even comics, with all their myriad crossovers, can't quite touch in terms of scope and breadth.
So two final questions. One, was there any one person who dreamt this initially or who saw this initially and was like, here's the idea? Or did this really come up out of a primordial stew?
As much as you can pinpoint a single source, I think Keith Gao would be the one who was on the Usenet boards back when and was talking about it with these people and then really put in the work along with his other buddy, who I think was an online buddy, to really start tracking down what is every show that's crossed over with every other show. And by the time they were done, they had something like over 400 shows that crossed over, you know, in some way had some connection, however tenuous, to St. Elsewhere. And nowadays, I think we're approaching 600 on the latest updates of the map. There are a couple major genesis points of this. One of them, and where I think it really started to spread widely, was a blog post by this comics writer, Dwayne McDuffie, who in 2002 wrote about the phenomenon of the Tommy Westfall universe and all these connections, except he was doing it kind of to debunk it. He was doing it saying that the reason he was, you know, he's a comics writer, and he's saying, please stop obsessing over what it means that Spider-Man showed up in X-Men. Please stop bothering me about this. If we take this to its logical conclusion, then you'd have to say that every TV show exists in the mind of the boy from St. Elsewhere. And of course, the internet took that and went, that's interesting. I really like that. So it was him, and then, you know, also
so McDuffie didn't realize what he was lit the fuse on.
Exactly. And he sort of, I think, was a major popularizer of the notion. But sort of parallel to that were these guys on the Usenet boards, Keith Gao and Ash Crow, who had already started doing the work to compile what all of the shows would be, all of the possible connections. So, you know, it's hard to track down, as with a lot of the stuff on the internet, one moment where the first guy ever said, hey, I've got an idea. What if this is all real? But there are a couple little genesis points that I think then build up steam together and make it the phenomenon that it is now.
So my final question is, you know, I'm on record as saying my favorite television show is 30 Rock, starring Tina Fey, America's best comic actor and writer. And my question is, is 30 Rock in the Tommy Westfall universe?
So not only is 30 Rock for sure in the Tommy Westfall universe,
wow,
via several crossovers, but in fact, and I will warn people of 30 Rock spoilers if you've not caught it in the last 15 years, the ultimate scene of the show, skip forward 30 seconds now, is Kenneth staring into a snow globe, a la St. Elsewhere, looking at the building 30 Rock, as a young woman pitches him the idea for the TV show 30 Rock.
So all of 30 Rock is a dream in Kenneth Parcell's mind.
It is. And I guess next up is the Kenneth Parcell universe, and I'll start working on that map next.
Because I remember that scene, and I just didn't realize that it was itself a play on a whole other internet universe. I just thought that was them being clever. I didn't realize it was quadruple clever.
Yes, as always, many, many layers going on there. And shows keep referencing St. Elsewhere. You know, the Colbert Show just ended recently, and their last scene was Colbert turning off the lights, or Paul McCartney turning off the lights at the Ed Sullivan Theater. which then gets zapped and shrunk down into a snow globe. So this still has some cultural cachet all these years later.
I guess. Okay, so Colbert. But wait a minute, that's real life. Now Paul McCartney's in the... That has violated the core tenet of the Tommy Westfall
universe. Right, you're right. Paul McCartney is unfortunately, tragically to us out here in the real world, we no longer have ownership over Paul McCartney.
Wow, okay. So there is... I mean, Colbert is such a scientist of popular culture. I'm surprised he would violate the one of the fundamental terms.
I know. It's in a way, you know, it could be why CBS canceled him. I've heard rumblings.
There it is. He violated some of the central tenets, the kayfabe. Well, I will just say right now that the Omnibus Project is not part of the Westfall universe because we are looking at it from the real world. We can see it. We're not in it.
Yes, no crossovers, and God forbid, keep Tom Fontana's grubby hands off your podcast.
And that concludes entry 1315.JO0714, certificate number 6555 in the Omnibus. Futurelings, you know that television is no longer what it was, what it once was. Television is no longer... We're in the fourth doldrum of television now. Not only are we not in the golden age, we're in the dark days. We're all going back to film. We're going back to screenwriting for film.
That's right.
And I've got some film ideas. I'm going to pitch you. I'm going to send you some of my screenplays that I haven't written yet. When I do write them...
Let me know. I'm excited. Okay. It's rare that you get a wunderkind coming right through Hollywood like you.
So. I want you to punch them up. I want you to put them into screenwriting talk or whatever and get them made. But you can, the other golden age that we're in is the golden age of YouTube, which continues to be the biggest social media site. And it's the one, I think, where you're maybe most able to never read the comments, right? You can go on YouTube every damn day and never read a single comment.
Yes, it is a blessing. Or you can go watch your favorite music video and see who's here in 2026. Take your pick.
But you can watch this program. You can see Thomas and myself talking to each other in real time where we can see each other's faces by going to youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. You can talk with other futurelings on Facebook and Instagram. Particularly the Facebook community is active under the Futurelings, Omnibus Futurelings, but you can also find communities on Reddit, Discord, elsewhere in social media, probably places that I don't even know exist. Little cockroach holes full of people talking about these episodes. You can send us email to theomnibusproject@gmail.com and we'll reply to your emails on our monthly addenda shows, which air for Patreon subscribers on patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can visit our website, which Thomas did in order to submit a proposal to do a show, to host, co-host a show of your own, omnibusproject.com/submit. And there's lots of other stuff there on omnibusproject.com. And you can send us actual mail, care of the Omnibus Project, to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington. That's B-U-R-I-E-N, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.